Those are Emma Lazarus's words for the Statue of Liberty, as set by Irving Berlin for a musical in 1949 called Miss Liberty. Lazarus's poem depicts a welcoming mother of exiles, embracing immigrants from many lands. But do Americans today continue to feel that way? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In the past, what caused various waves of immigration to the United States? Were the Chinese treated differently than the Italians? Do immigrants today help or hurt our economy? How can America learn from its past as it tries to shape immigration policy of the future? Joining us to explore immigration then and now is Thomas Archdeacon, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Becoming American, An Ethnic History.
Welcome back to University of the Air. Been a long time.
Yes, glad to be back.
When the subject of immigration comes up, I can't help feeling a twinge of sympathy for the American Indians who, you know, after all, got here first and the neighborhood's been going downhill ever since, what, about 1000 AD?
Yes. Well, at least since 1492, I suppose. No, it's an interesting way to look at that because typically when we think of immigration, we think of the Statue of Liberty, which initially had nothing at all to do with immigration. We think of Ellis Island, which definitely did have to do with immigration and dates from the same narrow set of years. But we can actually date immigration to North America rather than specifically the United States back to the 1600s. When the first wave of immigrants came, and those were the immigrants who came from Europe voluntarily and from Africa, usually involuntarily, to North America. And the host society waiting for them at that time was a group of Aboriginal people who had come to this area probably 10,000 years earlier. And that is one of the waves of immigration in America's immigration history. But we usually don't think of it as being a wave of immigration, maybe because it doesn't fit with the usual narrative that we have, which is that a wave of people comes, those already there are a little bit skeptical about the value of these additions, the newcomers prove themselves worthy of being Americans, and the country is better off from the long time. Well, the people who came from Europe at that point, although they encountered a society, did not adapt to it. They overwhelmed it, absorbed it, sometimes killed it off, and established their own place. So not all mass movements of people into an area end up in successful absorption to the existing culture. But if you're thinking in terms of American history, we do have four waves of immigration, if you include that first one. And then we also have a better known one from the middle of the 19th century, one very relevant in the history of Wisconsin, when people like the Irish and the Germans and the various Scandinavian peoples predominated in that wave of migration. And then we have this third wave, the one that we kind of iconically associate with immigration, the ones that come at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the Italians, the Greeks, the Jews, the various Slavic peoples, whose coming both leads Emma Lazarus to write her poem. She herself was of Jewish background, although German Jewish background, and that's a group that really comes as part of the German immigration rather than as a specifically Jewish immigration, comes earlier. But she writes that, but you also have Ellis Island established, which is a measure of concern and vetting of these people as they come through because they're Not that the Irish and the Germans weren't suspect. They definitely were. But these people are even more suspect at that point. And ultimately, you get the immigration controls of the 1920s imposed. And then really we have a long hiatus in the immigration history of the United States due partly to the laws but also and maybe even more so at least until the 1950s due to the Depression and World War II. They just terribly interfere with the movement of people. And after World War II, you begin to get talk about reform and whether the system of restriction that's in place is fair, and you get changes to the law in 65. We can talk about in greater depth later if you wish. But subsequent to that, you get a new wave of immigration coming this time mostly from Asia and Latin America, partly made possible by the changes in the law, but probably responding more to broader socioeconomic conditions around the world. The changes in law facilitated it, not to the point that we don't have this new phenomenon of illegal immigration, undocumented immigration, because in effect the persistent restrictions in the law, the continuance of some numerical restrictions and the like means that that the people don't have as free as access as they once had.
I would guess that the first actual policy, immigration policy in this country, would have to do with the making illegal or phasing out the importation of slaves, wouldn't it?
Well, it does in a way. The Constitution actually says very little about immigration. And the one thing that it does say about immigration, it's rather indirect, and it has to do with prohibiting the Congress for 20 years from imposing any rules that would affect the importation of people into the United States. And what that was a way of referring to the issue of slavery and specifically the slave trade without using those words. And it is, in effect, a compromise. It says, all right, slavery is a reality. The trade is going to continue for a while, but let's assume that Congress will take its first chance, which will be around 1807, to end this slave trade, and that's what it does. Other than that, the Constitution says almost nothing about immigration. If you talk about naturalization, the Constitution provides for the idea of naturalizing people, that people can become citizens, but insofar as it limits immigration in any sense or the impact of immigration, what it does is it sets times that people must be citizens, lengths of time during which they must be citizens before they can run for various political offices, and likewise that if you're not naturalized by the time the Constitution is ratified, which is done by 1788, at that point you cannot be eligible to become president of the United States. So basically we have this understanding that if you're not born a U.S. citizen, you are not eligible for the presidency, and that still continues. And that obviously shows a little – probably it's mostly skepticism about adventurers, European adventurers,
right.
Somebody like perhaps Napoleon. It's a little bit early for Napoleon in 1788.
Thomas Paine.
Somebody coming over and sort of winning a popular thing, because they're feeling – they're very, very vulnerable at this point. We, 200 years later, don't have an appreciation really of how vulnerable that state was, and we know it turned out to be a very stable thing, but they had no way of knowing that it was going to be as stable as it turned out to be.
Well, I saw a quotation from Thomas Jefferson in his notes on Virginia in 1782 that interested me, because you can tell he's worried about immigration. Mm-hmm. He says, "Yet from such absolute monarchies we are to expect the greatest number of emigrants. Their principles with their language they will transmit to their children. In proportion to their numbers, they will share with us in the legislation. They will infuse into it their spirit, warp and bias its direction, and render it a heterogeneous, incoherent, distracted mass."
And Jefferson was well disposed to immigration relative to the set of them.
But he's worried somebody's going to come over with their ideas of monarchy and sort of wreck the plan,
okay.
Right?
Okay. Well, but if you abstract from that, it's essentially the same concerns, especially in the 19th century, less now. Sometimes regarding the Mexicans, you hear very vehement opponents of it saying – of Mexican immigration saying something like, well, this is part of an attempt by the Mexican government to undo the Mexican War and reclaim the Southwest. Outside of sort of extreme statements like that, you don't hear, well, the Chinese are coming and they're going to impose Chinese communism on it. You don't get that argument very much these days. Usually we assume that the people, except for minority sets of people, not minority groups, but you know, the odd person here and there who's a would-be terrorist or whatever is pretty much open to the American system or participating in it. But in the 19th century, there was quite a bit of worry. When the Irish were coming, even before the Great Famine sends a million of them here, leading spokesmen in the country, religious leaders, are saying that it's part of a conspiracy between the papacy and the Austrian monarchy, the very repressive Austrian government at the time, to capture the West from the United States, that these people are going to undermine democracy and the like. And certainly in the first part of the 20th century, there were concerns that the Europeans were the people who were bringing socialism and communism to the United States. That they
mid-19th century where it was hot in Europe.
Yeah, so – but especially late 19th century where you're really getting the thing and around the time of World War I when you're having the Russian Revolution, there's concern about the numbers of well, part of it comes because the United States has never had that tremendously large a radical movement. It has had it, and certainly it's had an impact, and at times we tend to overlook the impact of it. But in terms of electoral support, you got to go back to Eugene Debs and you wave the fact that he got a million votes one time. But that's, you know, in terms of the actual political impact, fairly minimal. But back then, they thought that these folks were going to be the stormtroopers, if you will, of the Russian Revolution to bring it here.
And what are the causes besides – I mean, the obvious one that we always think about is just people looking for a better economic situation. If you are suffering from famine, you go to a different place. But are there other causes besides that and looking for religious freedom?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, on the one hand, the looking for a better life economically, that's the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to causes. It's a little bit like the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson and the drafters say something along the lines that, you know, people will really suffer a lot until it gets just about impossible and then they'll go. And I think immigrants are like that in a way. They'll put up with a lot of harassment and lack of freedom and the like until if they don't want to trade the fact that they're surviving necessarily for jumping into the beyond. But when that question of survival economically gets added to the mix, that certainly will be enough to trigger it. I would say economics is the big drawing thing. Then there are questions of political liberty, religious liberty, and the like. I think most of the analysis, though, sees those as, in most cases, ancillary reasons, in a few cases, the central reason.
Well, one thing that I was thinking is when you were talking about the early immigrants, the ones that first came to Jamestown and so on, and you mentioned the slaves. Mm. Does that even count as immigrants? In other words, and also with the Chinese workers brought over to do the railroad and so on, it seems as if we've got such a different situation.
Well, you do and you don't. I mean, in terms of talking about immigration and saying the slaves are immigrants, if you assume that the word immigrant implies a degree of voluntariness, then obviously it's not applicable in that case. If you talk about migration in terms of the movement of people, however they are moved from one location to another, it's certainly part of the story of the peopling of what becomes the United States. If you think in terms of the interactions that occur often between immigrants and slaves as well as between the natives and the slaves, then it's a very incomplete story if you leave the slave part of it out. So the categories get somewhat inconsistent here. You always have to have that asterisk beside it. An African slave brought to the United States is a migrant in that he or she has come 1,000 or more miles to a new world. They're certainly not coming voluntarily, and that shouldn't be implied. And they're coming to stay and all that. The Chinese are now fit into a different situation. The critique of the Chinese at the time in the 1850s, but especially by the 1870s, the critique is getting very strong, is that the Chinese are in effect mini-slaves. They are like slaves because they're alleged to lack a certain degree of freedom. And the historians are really quite divided about that. I'd say most of them would deny that in its baldest statement. These people are not forced to come. They come voluntarily and the like. And so they're not. They are seen, however, as substituting for certain kinds of bound labor because of the way in which, in some cases at least, their labor is organized through intermediaries. And what you really have is a continuum of labor conditions. It was not uncommon for certain members of an ethnic group, the ones who were here a little bit earlier, the ones who had a little bit more money, the ones who knew how the game was played a little better, to serve as intermediaries or as labor contractors or like for these others, and in effect to control. In terms of Italians and Greeks, these people are known as padrones. Now, with the Chinese, you get this set of organizations known as the six companies, merchant companies. And the argument among the historians is really how much control did these merchant companies exert over these Chinese laborers? There's not a great deal of evidence that these laborers are physically bound in any sense. There are arguments that many of the laborers intended to return. Return was a common phenomenon. It seems to have been stronger among the Chinese than among certain other groups. It was a common return among most immigrant groups. And that they had been fronted. They had been advanced their costs of transportation and they had to pay that off. They incurred debts to these companies. And that if they didn't pay them off, then they wouldn't be able to go home. Or that the companies knew where their relatives were back in China, and if they were not cooperative, they could be punished. The kind of stories that we hear today about snakeheads bringing in people from China or coyotes running people across the southern border of the United States that they can bet back, although the present situation seems to be a little bit more explicitly criminal than these more subtle earlier relations. But the Chinese, how much of this is a perception on the part of the majority people that they don't really understand this culture and that they are different, and how much of it is the kind of employments in which they were involved, the mining and the – or not so much
railroad
mining.
Building.
Railroad building is really the big thing. They're on the periphery of the mining situation, but the railroad building is the big thing. And they're used as gang laborers the way they're performing similar kinds of tasks. But of course, the Irish, for example, were building railroads too when they were performing in gang labor, but they're not really perceived as being bound in the same way. How much of that is a real difference in condition and how much of that is a difference in perception? Well, that's what keeps historians in business. It's arguing about this.
Well, let's get some insights into how the phenomenon of illegal immigration began when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is two networks serving Wisconsin, the NPR News and Classical Music Network and the Ideas Network, with talk about issues that matter to you. Information about both networks is available at WPR.org.
America must be kept American. For this purpose, it is necessary to continue a policy of restricted immigration. Those who do not want to be partakers of the American spirit ought not to settle in America. That's Calvin Coolidge in his first message to Congress, December 1923. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Thomas Archdeacon, and we're talking about immigration then and now. So if America is drawing all these immigrants from other countries, mm-hmm. is it doing anything to actually attract them? I mean, here we have Calvin Coolidge saying, you know, America must be kept American while also bringing in immigrants.
Well, of course, Coolidge is making that statement right on the eve of 1924, which is the single most important year in that period for the passage of immigration restriction legislation. But the point you make here about, well, why are all these people coming and what's drawing them, that's very good. And that actually gets back to this question of the economics of immigration and, well, why do these people feel the need to come? The theme that seems to hold together all the episodes of immigration is, especially the ones since the United States has become independent, is that the sending countries and the receiving country, in this case the United States, there are other receiving countries as well, but I mean the United States is the one which we're concerned right now, usually have some kind of relationship between the two. It's a commercial relationship. The means of transportation to get from one point to the other have to be there. And so you get that. And often the fact that the United States or any receiving country and the sending country have come into economic contact and exchange of ideas and exchange of goods and the like, it ties in these connections at times aggravate or trigger economic shifts in the structures of those sending countries. Usually when immigration occurs, you're in the following demographic situation. The country from which the people come has reached a point in its development where it has achieved fairly modern levels of success in terms of protecting people's health. At least, you know, the very high death rates of high-pressure demographic systems that you see in very undeveloped countries has passed. And you get a period in which the death rate has come down dramatically, but people don't respond to it by reducing family size. They're continuing to have large families because especially in that time in the country's development, children are workers for the family economy. They're sources of support for the parents when they're in old age. Not all children survive is the expectation. And until people recognize that a higher percentage of their babies are going to survive, and until such time as the society reaches a level of development that it institutionalizes things such as old age support and the like, you get a continuing high birth rate while the death rate is falling. And you get a population bulge there. And in a way, I compared this, it's not the same phenomenon at all in a sense, but if we think of what's going on with immigration, it makes a useful analogy, a little bit like the baby boom after World War II. All of a sudden, you have a group of people that you didn't expect to be there, and there they are, and for the next 50 or 60 years, they're going through the system like the pig and the python, you know, requiring new schools, requiring new roads, new houses.
And in their wake, things shrink back down.
That's right. And so what's happening with these sending societies is that they have this burst of population, and it takes maybe a half century or three quarters of a century for the society to get back into balance. And in the meantime, it can't absorb all these people, and they're looking for a way out. Now, in some societies where you do have, let's say, a country is lucky enough to have a fairly high level of internal development, maybe a country like France in the 19th century, a country like England, a good portion of that surplus population will be driven off farms and they'll go into factories and the like and find some outlets. The less, though, that they have of that kind of alternative economic development to traditional farming, the more that these people are then forced out of the country entirely. They need to go someplace else. And what they'll have is they'll have ties because they have knowledge, they're in contact with farther away countries, there's the mechanisms for getting there, there's the knowledge of them, and they start coming out. Now, some scholars argue, and I don't think it's true in all situations, but it is true in some situations, that at times the dominant country has in part exerted transforming efforts on the sending country. This would have been the case, for example, in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century. English influence was changing Ireland, and especially after the famine, where the English are determined to see Irish agriculture become more rational, better balance between people and land and the like. That's going to create a situation where people have to live. The United States' great dominance in the Western Hemisphere, especially in the northern half of the Western Hemisphere, that's going to have an effect. I mean, we grow sugar in the United States, and at times we're subsidizing the growth of sugar, for example, in Florida. And so what we do is part of that pressure helps put Jamaican sugar growers out of business. And so then we import Jamaican workers to harvest sugar in Florida because their own sugar industry has been undercut. And they talk about that as a core-periphery relationship. Now, it doesn't always exist. Like 19th century, the United States really was a peripheral country, but it was still attracting people because it had all this land and thing. I don't think it was exerting the effect on the – certainly wasn't affecting Ireland and Germany and Scandinavia, at least not in the first half of the 19th century, the way it is probably affecting Mexico right now.
So where – does the first illegal immigrant come?
Well, the first illegal immigrant is defined into existence. I mean, if you don't have any rules saying you can't come in, then you don't have any illegal immigration. Ronald Reagan used to make a comment that his grandfather or his great-grandfather was an illegal immigrant. And what he – was so often the case with Reagan, he would – tolerate a factual inaccuracy to make a more subtle point effectively. And what the situation was that one of his ancestors had come from Ireland to Canada at the time of the famine and had walked across the border into the United States. If he were to have done that today, he would be entering illegally, but there was no such definition. And it was very common to have that kind of cross-border traffic in the middle of the 19th century. So until you say it's illegal, it's not. And where illegal immigration comes, well, I suppose anyone – once you set up places like Ellis Island and Angel Island in the 1890s, Angel Island comes a little bit later, 1910 or so it opens. But once you establish places like that and have criteria about that you're not bearing certain diseases and you're not an anarchist and you're not likely to become a public charge – and then if you decide that, well, I'm never going to pass that test and you jump off the boat and sneak in, or if you're a sailor on a ship and you get shore leave and you don't, then in effect you're an illegal immigrant. Those tended to be fairly few. Probably where we get the illegal immigration more is after the 1920s when we get these – well, the United States still takes in many more people than most any other country in the world. But if you think in terms that we went from taking in 1 million a year on the eve of World War I and we dropped down to 150,000 a year plus some immediate relatives as of 1929, it's fully in effect. That means that some of those people, those that other missing 750,000, 850,000, some of those people, if they attempt to come, are going to do it. And clearly, this has an impact on the southern border of the United States, which was very much like the Canadian border. Companies did not respect it. The copper mining companies would operate on both sides. The railroad companies would operate on both sides. They'd move people back and forth. And even once we begin to try to regularize the passage on that border around the time of World War I, in part because they're concerned about German spies and saboteurs coming in via Mexico. But growing on top of that, you get the establishment of the Border Patrol in 1924, and it becomes a – and then with the Depression, it becomes a greater concern about people coming in and straining existing resources. So you get that. And then, of course, then it's after World War II, and what may trigger it is the 1930s, a lot of states will deny relief to immigrants during the Depression. And one thing that a number of states did was they would – a Mexican family would come in to apply for relief, and they'd, you know, hem and haw a bit and suggest that they'd be perfectly willing to pay their way back to Mexico if they thought that might be a better alternative. And some of the families take it. They say that the population of Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the U.S. dropped by about 500,000 between 1929, 1935 or thereabout. So you get this. And the Mexican government is kind of burned by this. They're not terribly happy that these people are being dropped back on their economy. They're suffering the Depression as well. And then all of a sudden in 1942, we find ourselves in need of agricultural labor because the soldiers are going off to war and Rosie's getting a rivet gun and they need people to work on the farms. And so they come up with an organized recruitment program, this Bracero program, to bring people in. And the Europeans, based on their World War II, post-World War II experience, say there's nothing as permanent as a temporary worker. And so what happens is that this creates a great deal of knowledge about opportunities in the United States. There's more demand for these jobs than there are jobs available under the Bracero program. The administration of the Bracero program between the 40s and the 60s is a story on to itself that's just too detailed to get into right now. But in effect, what we do is we establish a relationship with Mexican labor that draws them close to the U.S. border. We continue to rely on it after the war, that the Bracero program with fits and starts goes on up to 1964, at which point we've discovered all these migrant workers who are being badly mistreated, and we cut off the Bracero program. So then what do you do then? You have all this these people, some of whom previously had a legal outlet for work, and now they've been deprived of that in a way for their own protection, it said. And so that continues. And this creates – well, it is undocumented immigration. These are people that the United States officially says it does not – want in the economy, that it can't adequately protect in the economy, and it's seeking to discourage them from coming. And yet there is some market, obviously, for their services, whether it's as agricultural workers, whether it's in terms of domestic service, skilled labor.
Sometimes I gather a flexible or a fluctuating market, a seasonal market in some cases, or in some cases one that has to do with just the state of the economy over some period of time.
That's right. I mean, and with the agricultural workers, it certainly is a seasonal economy. Here are people who are needed for X number of months during the year, and then they may or may not be needed, probably not needed for most of the other time. Over time, that changes. More of them start getting into other kinds of work that's not quite as seasonal. And this is really now, this is really where it gets quite difficult to come up with, I'm tempted to say, an honest answer. Probably it's safer to say an accurate answer. I go for the word honest initially because you have advocates and of immigration and opponents of immigration, and they each have an agenda here as to, well, we really need these workers. The economy would collapse without them. And then the other side saying, well, everyone who comes in is taking an American's job. The answer is somewhere in between.
Because not Americans would necessarily not want all of the jobs that
these people take. Well, they don't want, although the opponents would say, well, if the Mexicans or anyone else, let's not just sort of focus on the Mexicans, but anyone who is coming in this circumstance, if they were not available, then the employers would have to improve the jobs by making them better paid and better working conditions to draw out the people who are not willing to expose themselves to the current conditions, and therefore the labor force would be available. That's probably not true completely either. But you have some incredibly intelligent people and people, economists, whose arguments I have to go through with extreme care, trying to follow their math and everything like that, and people whom I know on both sides of the issue who are very honest people. And it's just tough. I mean, figuring out what the economic – we know there's some good. We know that there's some bad. What exactly the extent of the good and bad is, it's very, very tough to figure this out.
When you get into economics, yes.
And can you say something about the quota system in this country and sort of its history and where we are now in terms of how many people from which countries can come, how that's regulated?
Well, the big thing with the quota system, and it ties back to President Coolidge's comment back in 1923, there was a perception at that time that certain people were harder to absorb than other people. They were less desirable. And that's a show in and of itself as to what made them less desirable, all kinds of racist assumptions and the like. But if you wanted to minimize it, you would just say that some people had a harder time succeeding economically because of lack of training or whatever. So they go and they say, well, what would be fair way? Well, let's take a look at America in 1920. Who's here? What are their ethnic backgrounds? And when it comes to immigration, we'll allocate the percentage of immigrants so that we, in effect, replicate the existing society. Now, that also has the advantage from the perspective of the restrictionist is that it cuts down the people that they're least happy to see, because these people are the groups or from the groups that have arrived most recently. The Pilgrims and their descendants have been reproducing for 400 years. They have quite a head start in this race. The Italians and the Jews have been here since 1900, let's say, for a rough thing. They just have that one generation. So what happens is you get an allocation based on ethnic background, and then you get an overall cap that, as I said, was when they finally came down with the figures, 150,000 people a year. Now, certain people like the spouses of citizens and the minor children of citizens are let in beyond that number. But that's the visa number for the counted immigration that they have. We keep that up to 1965. And in 1965, they say, well, this is really unfair. And what they do is they go to what I call a United Nations framework or General Assembly framework. They say every nation is equal. And what we'll do is we'll set up a situation where each nation has access to the same potential number of entry slots each year. Now, the rule that they put on it is they say no nation can send more than 20,000 in a given year.
And this is no nation, regardless of whether you're talking about India or
whether
Swaziland.
India, China, Ireland, Haiti, France, it doesn't make any difference how big you are. And I don't see that really as an immigration policy more. That, I see that as sort of retrospective rather than prospective, because what they're really saying is we're cleaning our hands. We don't want to say that any group is better able to become American than another group. All countries are equal in our eyes. And as it turns out, now, certain countries will send at least the 20,000, and that's where you get into all the loopholes in immigration law. But it wasn't that every country could send 20,000, the most that they could send, because if you count up how many countries are in the United Nations, for example, divide that into 150,000, and you're going to find out on average it's not going to be 20, it's going to be far below 20,000. So it's limited. But still, it does, because of the way they set it up, it helps trigger the immigration from countries like Asia, because they change certain of the criteria for getting in. And the countries that had very long backlogs, where people who wanted to get access to the few slots who were available had to be willing to wait a long time, those countries all of a sudden find themselves in a place where their long wait is rewarded. And people coming from countries where it had been pretty easy before, where you could just sort of apply and the next year maybe the slot would be open because your demand wasn't that high. All of a sudden, they find themselves in the back of the line. And then once – the trick is with the American immigration system, once you get your foot in the door and then you start triggering family reunification, that flips the whole system very quickly, because soon you find that the people who want to come to the United States – the bulk of them who actually have the people in the United States who can trigger their right to come to the United, or their possibility to come to the United States, are from the most recent nations, from the ones that they get this boost then. And that then changes the whole dimension. So I think the percentage of people coming from Europe now is around 10 to 15%, which is a total change from what it was. Part of that represents, well, Europe's very developed. People are doing reasonably well there. The euro is better than the dollar.
Irish economy is back.
Yeah, Irish Celtic Tiger and all that. You have that stuff. And so the demand isn't as great. But part of it is also the mechanism of how the law works. But still, we're talking the United States legally now expects around 700,000 immigrants a year. It expects around 700,000. It gets around at least 1 million, and last year it was 1.5 million.
There are a few loopholes there, though.
So and that has to do with now if you're the parent of an adult U.S. citizen, the spouse of a U.S. citizen or the minor child of a U.S. citizen, you come in outside. There were 500,000 people who came in under that category last year. And then there's a special provision for refugees who were separated out from the law in 1980. Because the rationale for admitting refugee is different from the rationale for admitting an immigrant.
And the element of political asylum comes in?
Yeah, political – refugee and asylum is essentially the same thing, very close. The refugee is processed abroad. The asylee shows up on your doorstep and demands to be admitted. And international law prohibits the sending of a person back to danger.
Yes.
And so the country is morally compromised by this, and this is why governments, not only the U.S. but all of them, so dislike asylum cases, in that they are put in a morally awkward position immediately. When the person shows up and challenges them to send them back, they just don't like that. But that brings in 100,000, and now they estimate that about 300,000 people a year are people who have entered without documents and who have effectively settled permanently in the United States. There's a lot of undocumenteds who go back and forth. They fluctuate. There's probably several million who come in a given year. Most of them will leave again fairly shortly. But each year, and it may be after a process of being in the country for 4 or 5 years, making repeated trips, they say about 300,000 people who have entered without documents now effectively are part of American society. It's those kind of cases that you hear about on the news that touch you emotionally or whatever, because you hear about this person finally being found out and the government wants to remove them and they have all these ties to the society and it seems so unfair for them to be removed. And on the other hand, the government says, well, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to reward lawbreakers.
Yes, you hear that a lot now, don't you?
You get that going back. Those are the kind of
amnesty
people that I'm talking
versus rewarding people to come in illegally.
So those are that 300,000 there. So you get 700,000 coming in under kind of regular programs for family reunification and employment and diversity, another 100,000 plus for refugees, 500,000 immediate family, and then 300,000 undocumented but effectively settled people.
Anytime I hear the news about immigration, I feel it's kind of a mess that it's hard to see where the solution is, since you can't let everybody in, but at the same time, as you mentioned, it's a very emotional issue and there are people here who should. There's also the question of Mexicans who are aware that California at one point seemed to be Mexican. Mm. So I guess with your historical background, looking at the current situation, what are the questions that you think people ought to be asking and how do we come toward a solution?
That is very hard. I don't think that most of the Mexicans who are coming across the border are irredentists or looking for the recapture of the Southwest. I think there are a few spokespersons, Latino activists and the like, who may think in those terms. I don't think they have a very strong historical argument. Mexico's claims to California were not really much better. I mean, people of partly Spanish origin coming north to California in 1776 to exploit the Indians there is hardly a much more honorable tradition than people coming from the East Coast to California to exploit the Indians 50 or 60 years later. These are California, the heart of Mexico is down by Mexico City. The northern part of Mexico is a very remote area without much population. California is the far, far frontier of Mexico in the same way that it was potentially of the United States. I don't think that's a very strong historic argument. Whether it's true or not really doesn't make any difference. It's how often you say it and who you can get to believe it. I think most of the Mexicans who are coming are coming simply for jobs. They may feel very comfortable because in reality there is a kind of border culture between the United States and Mexico in the same way that there's a border culture between the United States and Canada. 90% of the Canadian people live within 100 miles of the American border. And Canada struggles to maintain an independent identity of the United States, and it has various rules about the distribution of media and the like. But the fact that they feel that need suggests how mutually infused those borders are. And I think Mexico, perhaps because there's a different language involved, yes, with Canada you have French in some areas, but it's mostly an English-speaking country. At least we don't perceive it as a different language situation. Mexico, because it's Spanish, perhaps that sense of, well, gee, we have a common border with something. We're so Anglophone in this country that may be not instinctive for us to think about it. But realistically, this is a culturally shared area. We certainly had a lot of impact down in Mexico, too, probably more than we recognize that they have impact here.
Well, one of the, I guess, symbols of the concern that we see now with Mexicans, and I'm sure we've seen it to some extent in the past, but it seems to be bigger than ever, and that is language and assimilation. I mean, there is so much Spanish language broadcasting, advertising, communication in general in this country that some people are concerned that it will create a country of two cultures that don't overlap as much as the cultures in this country traditionally have.
And I think that if you were to figure out a country that a situation in which that kind of break, for example, similar to the English-French tension in Canada could arise, although from somewhat different historical origins, I think probably saying that about Mexico is not absolutely irrational. I mean, there are some people who may be quite racist or whatever, but there are legitimate questions.
Practical concerns.
Practical concerns involved with that. I think a lot of the evidence suggests that the fears may be somewhat exaggerated. The Mexicans, first of all, if we go back in our own history, there were groups that were very retentive of their language and more or less had to be pried from it. The Germans, for example, were quite retentive of it. And who knows, if World War I hadn't come along and almost the forced suppression of the German language, how vital it would have remained. My feeling is that it wouldn't, that it was dying out as it was. I'm inclined to think that certainly in certain areas of where the United States has a common border with a Spanish-speaking world, more and more people on both sides of those borders are likely to be bilingual. That's a regional thing. I think, though, in terms of the absorption of people, for example, up in Wisconsin or New York or a lot of other places, and indeed everywhere, that most of the Spanish-speaking people existing in the United States will be predominantly English-speaking in terms of their day-to-day discourse, or able to speak English in terms of their day-to-day discourse over time. I would be reluctant to see Spanish given a special status, and the thing, not for anything against Spanish, but so much that it raises questions about the other people. There are school districts in California where you have 41 different languages being spoken. And why you would take one language that is not the historic language of the country, and sort of give that a privilege above other languages. I don't know what the constitutional rationale for that would be. I could see a practical rationale in a way, but I think it would raise as many political questions among other groups. As relaxing as it might be to Latinos, it would probably be very irritating to Asians and or a number of others, or it would trigger a string of requests for legal recognition of other language that logic or constitutionally might be difficult to resist. Even the telenovelas that they have on on Spanish language television now, they're apparently having to translate some of these into English.
Oh, really?
Because the format appeals to young people, the kind of people who like to watch telenovelas or soap operas or whatever. But some of them now want it in English. And so you're getting the phenomenon of, you know, if you wanted to think of the soap opera starting off in English and then being copied into Spanish, now you have the Spanish being copied back into English. So I'm not desperately concerned about that over time. It is a practical problem. And anytime you have immigration by any group, it complicates a society. If you're adding students, regardless of what language they have, but they're not English-speaking students, and you're adding them to classrooms at a high rate, well, that complicates the teaching. I mean, it's not the kids are bad or not able to do the work or anything like that. It's just logistically a complication.
Complicates so, and enriches at the same
time. It enriches at the same time. It exposes people to difference. That's good. But if you're trying, you know, to teach arithmetic, for that particular task, it probably not being able to do it in a single format at least increases the number of personnel that you have to employ in order to do it in multiple formats. It's not that this is a trivial issue or that there's not reason for concern, but as you say, there's enrichments to it, there's risk to it, there's both and.
Makes that whole immigration phenomenon a difficult one to assess and to come up with a good practical humanitarian approach to handling.
Our guest has been Thomas Archdeacon. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.